This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters, and culture. Genocide and colonization are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey, welcome back to Auspulse Snack Pod, the weekly podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes, and we're also the official podcast of the Auspulse Shitposting Facebook group, which you can find just hop on facebook.com/groups/Auspulse Shitposting. My name's Noon. On Facebook, I'm Ino Funkenstein, and I'm the admin and creator of Auspulse Shitposting, and with me, as always, is my erstwhile co-host...
Hey, Zach LeSnack. I'm a mod on the Auspulse Shitposting Facebook group, and really, my main thing is this, being co-host of the show. Yeah.
Yeah. We're recording this on Saturday, the 25th of April, which is the day before that it's going to come out to you guys, but obviously, it's an important day that all...
Special weekend.
All patriotic Australians, I would say, are aware of and celebrate in whatever way. I know some people were out early this morning... 6 a.m. out on the driveway before dawn, having, you know, their last snack for the day because it's Ramadan.
Yes.
So, Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Mubarak.
To everyone. Ramadan
to you and yours.
Yeah. I hope you're all having a solemn and reflective month remembering Muhammad.
Yeah. Madam.
The other thing I just want to mention up top was that this week we released our bonus episode to everyone, to the public, because we thought it was a good one that we put quite a bit of research into and that we learned a lot doing, and there was some stuff there that we regularly say on the show, like, oh, we don't really have time to go into this in a whole lot of detail, which we did, and we got really nice feedback about that episode. So thank you to everyone who listened to that, and thank you to our patrons who support the show with their cash dollars.
Yeah. Big time. That was a very research-heavy episode, as Noon mentioned, and like I have trouble at the best of times maintaining a full-time job and doing all the reading and writing necessary for this podcast. So this episode, I think, is going to be a little sillier, a little looser.
We picked some more fun topics to...
Yeah, we've sort of avoided most of the more serious shit that went down this week. Anyway, this should be hopefully a little bit lighter.
So I'll start us off with our entrees, and for this we're having a nice oily salad dressing because there's been a bunch of stuff about oil in the news this week. One sort of headline that was quite misleading was that oil was selling for -$30 a barrel, which is like technically true but not actually true. There was like some complicated shit with contracts ending up, and basically it was like people who were not very good at oil trading who were selling it for -$30 a barrel. It was... pretty amusing, in my opinion. It's the first time that's ever happened in history, even in this like kind of chunky, not really way that it happened. But in the background of this is that a story that I believe we've mentioned a couple of times in the show, that Australia has an international treaty that we've signed that says that we promise to always have at least 90 days worth of oil on shore in reserve, just in case something goes wrong. And there's like there's a lot of countries in this agreement, and Australia actually has somewhere between like 30 to 50 days in reserve. And hilariously, a large amount of that reserve is underground in Louisiana in the continental United States. So we don't have our full 90 days, but most of our reserve is not actually on shore. The Australian government took the opportunity of this like really low oil price to buy about 5 days worth, which is cool. And experts kind of being like, yep, this is really good. This is what we should be doing. You'd start getting 90 by getting five more or whatever. But yeah, I just think it's very funny. And it's been funny watching the minister try to explain how Louisiana counts as accessible to Australia. Yeah. So anyway, that was just a fun little...
Wait, because he's competent and a good communicator at the best of times.
Yeah.
Old Angus.
Roberts, I think. Angus Taylor, of course. Yeah. There's a whole lot of fun international poll stuff about why the oil prices are so low, but Zach will resent me deeply if I talk about it. So instead, we're going to move on to
Shitpost of the week.
So this week we have a couple of big shitposts from... And those are shitposts, by the way, not shitposts.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely from quite shit.
Some of the biggest names in shitposting in the nation. First one I wanted to mention was a big old shitpost that was being circulated. I think it was initially, it came from Parliament House. In fact, the Prime Minister's office, to be specific. This is a shitpost called A Bigger Picture, also known as Malcolm Turnbull's autobiography about his... Well, it covers most of his life. I read the first page, which was very annoying. It was about listening to his mum write radio plays in a very expensive flat in a fancy suburb of Sydney called Vaucluse, where he grew up. And it also covers his time in office and stuff. But the reason it's been in the news is because it was pirated and distributed from someone, from a staffer in the Prime Minister's office, to at least 59 other people. And I think it was one of those people who received it and then tipped off Turnbull. And so that staffer has now been forced to do like an out-of-court settlement with the publisher. Hilarious. And the publisher has like vowed to legally pursue those other at least 59 people who also received the pirated manuscript of Malcolm Turnbull's autobiography before it was released. So, I mean, I love... This is very funny for a few reasons, but mostly just, like, obviously everybody knew that basically the book was going to be start to finish just him absolutely shitting on everybody who he thought did him dirty in the Liberal Party. Yep. And it seems...
Everyone in the Liberal Party.
Yes, and it basically seems to be that, but everybody was just, like, clearly... All those Liberal ministers are just like couldn't possibly wait to see what he said about them when it came out in the press. Like they had to know. So everybody's just like feverishly flicking through this PDF, name searching themselves, trying to find what type of shit Turnbull has said about them. And one of the things that has kind of come out of it is that Turnbull has started to try to distance himself from everything that Peter Dutton did under his prime ministership. Because it was under Turnbull that the Home Affairs Office was established and Dutton was given this huge amount of power. But the other thing that happened while Turnbull was prime minister was that Peter Dutton tried to stir up the whole African gangs thing. And there was the line about people being scared to go out to restaurants in Victoria, which was obviously laughable to everybody who lived here. And I came across as well on Twitter a clip of Christopher Pine from The Time, and a journalist was asking him if he was afraid to go out to restaurants. Yeah, and he just like laughed and was like, no, why should I be? And they were like, yeah, because of that. And he's like, oh, right, the gangs. Yes,
the gangs,
yes.
The African gangs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Terrifying. But so at the time, like Turnbull basically rolled over on this Peter Dutton line of like racial vilification. And he
just like let it go on.
Yeah, he said something along the lines of there is a gang problem and you're not going to get rid of it by pretending it doesn't exist or something right. along those lines. And so there's one of the fun things that has also happened this week is that Turnbull has hopped onto Twitter and we now have... entered an exciting new era of extremely online ex-prime minister, which is great.
Yeah.
Because Turnbull, if you want to go and like have a Twitter argument with Malcolm Turnbull, apparently he will respond to
he's
you.
In.
He's down for it. So there was a tweet from a Guardian journalist called Greg Jericho who retweeted an SBS interview that Turnbull gave as part of the press tour for this book, where basically he was like, yeah, it was my bad letting the African gangs shit slide. And then Turnbull came in and said kind of some snarky stuff. They go back and forth a little bit. And then Turnbull says, I think if you read what I said at the time, it was carefully stated. And then Greg Jericho says, like, yeah, it doesn't matter whether or not you were carefully stating your support for racial vilification. You were still doing that. Also, carefully stated might be the perfect description of your prime ministership. At which point Turnbull responds, I don't understand how someone who writes thoughtfully on economics in The Guardian could be so unpleasantly abusive on Twitter.
Hilarious.
It says a lot for the quality of the editorial oversight at The Guardian, I suppose. Which, lol.
Jeez.
And Malcolm Turnbull has now blocked Greg Jericho on Twitter. So, you know, the greatest men in our nation's history, those people who have forged our national spirit and legacy and narrative with their bare hands, are just as prone to having Twitter meltdowns as the rest of us, really, when it comes down to it. So there's something comforting in that. It's a little bit like the tradies near my house the other day who were blasting What If God Was One of Us?
Hilarious.
On their radio the other day, which I was just like, fuck, I haven't heard that in ages.
Yeah. Who listens to that? Yeah.
And I honestly thought that it was a Simpsons joke that the rhyme is just a slob like one of us, but that's the actual...
No, that's the actual song. Yeah.
Yeah. So Malcolm Turnbull turns out to be just a slob like one of us, as far as I can tell.
There were two things that I wanted to add about this whole pirated books situation.
Please do.
The first was that someone in response to this whole like litigation situation has created an online bit.ly link, which is bit.ly/wankerbook, and it takes you to a PDF of Malcolm Turnbull's biography, which is just like a premium. Yeah, good. And they had to pay for that to get the like coherent URL, which is very funny. And the other thing is that...
Worth it.
I have no interest whatsoever in reading Malcolm Turnbull's autobiography, but I strongly recommend the quarterly essay that Annabelle Crabb wrote about him, which was like long before he was prime minister. It was called Stop at Nothing. And it features the lyrics of a musical that he wrote about Hitler.
Oh,
yes! And a bunch of other absolutely hilarious shit. Including people like literally leaving town to avoid him. and a bunch of other... Yeah, very funny things. So,
God,
strongly recommend that one. It's much shorter as well.
Such a piece of shit. And he's really framing this like piracy thing as like, oh, it's not about me. This is a big deal for publishers.
For
not
publishing.
Just my publisher, but publishers generally, is what he said. and some of the other responses from other people has been very funny. Like Maurice Payne, I think it was on Insiders, and she was asked whether or not she got the pirated PDF email, and she said that she, quote, had received and deleted the email. And Matt Canavan said that he received it 4 or 5 times, but had not read the book.
Very funny.
Which is great. But look.
That was our first shit post.
Yes, and look, we can all agree that Turnbull is a piece of shit, completely spineless, and is now trying to like whitewash his legacy as prime minister by distancing himself from the like absolutely horrific racism and discrimination that was perpetrated by that government. Which, yeah, he deserves absolutely no fucking sympathy if he's trying to, like, I don't know, get points for, like, oh, no, it was the other people that was racist, and I didn't like what was happening, but, you know, ooh, my hands
were
tired.
But you were the fucking prime minister, man.
Yeah, just, like, I don't know, fucking stick up for what you claim to be your values. But whatever. All that said, I will admit, he's not got an awful turn of phrase. I don't know how much ghostwriting went on, but there was one little quote I wanted to read. This was pulled out in a tweet by Bill Williams. That's at Victor Moa, M-O-A, 888. So I haven't actually found this quote in the book itself. I'm basing it on this guy's tweet. So it's possible that I'm wrong about this, but it sounds very accurate. Mm-hmm. So the tweet says, in a bigger picture, Turnbull devotes a single paragraph to Lyle Shelton. Quote, Lyle is an ugly man, a deranged god-botherer who tried to claim a terror attack occurred on the ACL premises. He was always hanging around the men's toilets in the ministerial wing of Parliament House.
Which, as I said when you read this to me the first time, really makes me dislike both of them a lot, this quote.
Yeah, most people hanging around Parliament fucking deserve each other, clearly. Mm-hmm. We can agree that Lyle Shelton is an ugly man.
Yes, that's
very
true.
And a
god-botherer, yeah.
Always trying to claim this terror attack thing, which, if you look into it, it's just a really sad story as well, and him trying to use it for his own sort of political goals is fucked. But so Lyle Shelton, for those who don't know, is he was for a while probably one of our most public conservative religious bigots, I guess.
Yeah.
And he's sort of faded from public view, at this stage.
He was leading the anti-marriage equality campaign. That was sort of when he was like most prominent on the scene. And of course, listeners may remember the Eat Shit Lyle concept, which is just to say eat shit Lyle at Lyle whenever he says anything. So,
yeah, complete and utter asshole, and has sort of faded into obscurity since the same-sex marriage plebiscite. He did briefly, I think, join Cory Bernardi's Australian Conservatives Party. So he did have a brief crack at getting into politics, but that hasn't worked out. He also managed to mysteriously get his hands on this illegal advance copy of Malcolm Turnbull's autobiography and started like rage blogging about it pretty much immediately. Mostly from the perspective of same-sex marriages has the passing of same-sex marriage is like undermining children's rights and is, you know,
classic stuff.
Yes. Absolutely. Classic Lyle. He has, I guess, partially in like response to Malcolm Turnbull, posted the cover from his own forthcoming autobiography, which is entitled, I Kid You Not, subtitled Notes from 20 Years in the Trenches of the Culture Wars, with this like just absolutely shithouse cover design with this like 100 by 150 resolution photo of himself. And the title of the book had like a typo in it.
Yep.
The second word of the title of the book had a typo in it. And there was a great exchange on Twitter between Brocklesnitch, which is the handle of Beck Shaw, who's a TV writer and also a prominent tweeter, who responded to this by saying, what's going on with the font and decisions to capitalize some words here? Lyle responded, thanks, Beck. We'll be fixed. Beck Shaw says, no worries. While you're there, you should delete all the words in between the covers as well.
Great.
Just completely demolished, which is lovely to see. Like, I think Beck Shaw sits at this perfect level of like, she's a known tweeter on the kind of Australian left, but not well known enough that someone like Lyle Shelton would have
knows
any idea
to avoid.
Who she is.
Yeah, right.
So like, she can just set the trap, wait for him to walk into it, and then just absolutely destroy him on his own post, which is honestly heartwarming to see.
There was another funny little aspect of this whole book situation, which is I saw a tweet from Lyle Shelton on the other day. He said, just logged onto the publisher's website to see this. Thanks to everyone who's pre-ordering, whatever. The tweet was saying that his book was a top seller on the publisher's website. And I was like, I wonder what this publisher is that Lyle Shelton's book is one of the top sellers. And I only got as far as like clicking onto the website because the menu at the top of their website just immediately told me everything that I needed to know about them. This is Connor Court Publishing, and they've got this like list of different topics that their books are about. And I'm just going to read a couple of these out. Climate change, culture, mining, political philosophy, marriage, Snowflake Chronicle series, History Matters series, and Jeparit Press, which mainly publishes collections of Howard's speeches. So, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And the climate change stuff is all like, the real truth about climate change. It's not happening. And
amazing. Yeah. Yeah. No, just like basically this little funnel through which right-wing people kind of attempt to get book deals.
Mm-hmm.
The only related book that they suggest under Lyle Shelton's forthcoming autobiography is a book that, from memory, is titled The Case Against Public Broadcasting, subtitled Why We Need to Defund the ABC, which,
hilarious.
Yeah, very appropriate. The other really funny thing is on the publisher's site on the page about his book, it's got all the endorsements, and one of them is just from his sister, and it opens with this fucking iconic line: for as long as I have known Lyle, which has been all of my life, he has always stood for what is true, what is right, and what is just. And then she goes on to basically say in her endorsement of his book that he is terrible at what he does. She goes on to say, well, it seems like we are losing the battle on so many fronts. Lyle and usually a small team of people have swum against the flow to fight for the very values our nation was built on. It would seem as though Lyle has tasted defeat over and over. However, he continues to rise and fight.
He's also tasted shit over and over.
Yeah, so shouts to Letitia Shelton. Lyle and Letitia. Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. She apparently is also the CEO of City Women Toowoomba. So not to
downplay her credit.
Yeah, she's not just the sister of a shitty right-wing asshole. She is a shitty right-wing asshole mm-hmm. in her own right. Hashtag male feminist. Anyway. moving on.
Cool, yeah.
You fucked up.
Now, this is a delicious fuck-up. It is one that... It's so perfect, the trajectory of this whole thing. It's about Clive Palmer, everyone's favorite fuck-up of Australia. He's definitely mine.
We're covering a lot of Australia's, most consistently gold-plated fuckwits in this episode.
Hence the title, Cheesy Chumps, which isn't even particularly relevant to the mains. It's just that we're mentioning a bunch of giant, giant assholes. And, So Clive, I'm a little disappointed we haven't managed to get more Clive content on the show.
Noon's a big Clive fan.
I stan Clive, but I'm happy to have waited for such a cromulent fuck up. So as you probably all know, Donald Trump has been talking about hydroxychloroquine, which I also discussed at length in the previous episode, our bonus episode about how we're killing disabled people to deal with corona.
Nice pronunciation on that.
Thank you. I practiced it like 6 times this morning.
I can tell.
So Clive bought 32.9 million doses of hydroxychloroquine, which, remember, there's like 25 million Australians. So anyway, he took out big double-page newspaper ads being like, buy this miracle drug, or like, I'm giving this miracle drug to Australia. I think he's donating them. It's unclear. Now, at that time, there was no evidence that hydroxychloroquine was an effective treatment, and as such, the Therapeutic Goods Administration said that they were going to be investigating Clive Palmer for, like, falsely promoting medical treatments that don't work. Now, since then, studies have come out that have shown that hydroxychloroquine actually kill people with coronavirus much, much faster than not giving them hydroxychloroquine. And there was one trial that was published in JAMA, which said that they'd stopped conducting the trial because so many of their subjects had died. So now...
Jesus Christ.
Not only has, as I mentioned in the last episode, Clive... fucked a lot of people who actually need this drug for their actual conditions. He's now hopefully going to be sued for advertising it and is going to be sitting on this completely useless death medicine. So, nice. Nice one, Clive. Thank you for that delicious fuck-up. You've brightened my whole day. Listeners can't see, but Zach is, like, holding his head in a face palm and chuckling. yeah.
Who would have expected this from the Titanic 2 / Jurassic Park 2 guy? Mm-hmm.
Genius businessman Clive Palmer.
Well, pay your workers, you fucking asshole. Yep. Stop hoarding medicine that people actually need and trying to use it to poison people who don't need it.
Now, speaking of poisoning people and coronavirus, we received an excellent potluck this week. Now, as listeners may know, Potluck is the segment where listeners send in a voice recording of themselves talking for approximately a minute about whatever they want. And this week we have a lovely contribution from a friend, confidant, and member of our inner sanctum, Tom Tanaki, noted anti-fascist shit poster.
And 5G myth buster.
Yes, that's right. That's right. He busts a lot
Third
of myths.
Third eye opener, Tom Tanaki.
Wellness guru.
Sheeple
advanced
rouser,
mathematics guru,
7D chess specialist Tom Tanaki. Let's hear what he has to say.
Potluck, where you bring the snacks.
G'day, this is Tom Tanaki. Look, I know we think it's all about 5G towers causing coronavirus, but the truth is it goes a lot deeper, and I wanted to tell you all about some of the things I've been learning about lately from the conspiracy elements online, because there's been a lot of fusion of spiritual wellness types with QAnon conspiracy theorists. You know, as we know, it's like a Trump versus the deep state thing in America, but they've come over here and so they're sort of starting to make up ideas about what's really happening in Australia. What I've come to learn is that apparently Melbourne's layout is based on a four-dimensional hypercube design, which is meant to put everyone in Melbourne into a dream state so that we can, you know, so that they can control us all. And we've all been under that dream spell for years now. However, because there's various different factions of the cabal that are vying for control of the financial sector in Australia, and because some of the other factions have shut Australia down in order to be able to build all the 5G infrastructure up, they've stopped us from being able to go to the MCG. Now, why is the MCG important? Well, I've learned that the MCG channels energy through everyone cheering at the footy matches into the Melbourne 4D hypercube structure, therefore keeping everyone asleep. So now that's why all these conspiracy theorists have suddenly started waking up lately, because they're not being sent to sleep by the MCG-charged hyperdream dream spell construct that is Melbourne CBD layout. And if you think all that sounds cooked, well, you just need to fucking wake up, mate.
It's the hyperdream relay MCG dream awareness hypercube all along. I mean, it was right before our eyes.
I mean, you know, not on a visible wavelength,
no,
but
no.
It's been there the whole time.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, I also found out
about those.
Thank you, Tom.
Here.
Thank you very much for your rigorous, on the ground, hard hitting, fact based journalism around this issue. Without which I'm sure everybody would agree that we would be adrift in a sea of government propaganda, lies, and psyops. So we appreciate that. Also found out this week that my dog is a coronavirus truther and has been going around town, writing COVID number 19 is a lie. Look it up on charity bins around my suburb. So that was a tough one. I mean, I guess these weird conspiracy theories ultimately find people and who are just not maybe particularly savvy at using social media. But there's the conversation around conspiracy theories in general, and this is probably something that's a bit too big for us to get into right now, but maybe we can devote a bit more time to it in future. I mean, it makes sense to me. Like, there's so much stuff going on. You feel so powerless. Often, and like, there are several legitimate conspiracies going on. It's just that they're not as secret as people seem to think they are.
Or is carefully manufactured. Like, I feel like there's a lot of stuff that's just people being selfish, and then they cooperate with each other. And then you can call that a conspiracy theory, but sometimes it's just, you know, business or whatever. Like,
I mean, there's so much terrible stuff going on being done by the people who are in power. Why do you need to make up other stuff? But the answer to that is that obviously it's really hard to figure out how to dismantle an oppressive government structure, for example. Whereas it's much easier to say, no, I don't want your 5G. And also it's got the added bonus of I can be pretty racist about it.
Plus,
it's a Chinese thing. There's a real racial element to this whole 5G corona.
I think
obviously.
The other thing is that, as you say, when you're like, oh yes, perhaps it's the patriarchy and capitalism and whatever, isn't very empowering, but when it's, you know, the Chinese 5G communist CIA bird spies, you are suddenly the protagonist in a Dan Brown novel or an Alex Rider novel, and people love that shit, you know, especially when they're feeling unempowered. Suddenly they're
totally
a secret agent.
I think it dovetails really neatly into these other kind of pseudo-spiritual hippie beliefs about, like, alternate planes of existence.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. It's just about trying to, like, regain a little bit of control over your own existence and, like, quote-unquote destiny or whatever. Which, like, I totally understand, but, like... please just use fluoridated toothpaste. It's going to be so much better for you guys. I swear to God.
Okay, so now moving on to our First Nations story. This is from an ABC article by Vanessa Milton, and it's an interview with a man named Warren Foster, who's a Yuin man, and he is the traditional knowledge holder for his people, and he's telling the story about when his people first saw Captain Cook arrive. And I just thought it was really beautiful. And there's about 5 minutes of it. We're not going to play all of that. We're only going to play 30 or 40 seconds. But we'll put a link in the show notes. And I really recommend everyone watch it. It's short. It's really beautiful. And it's really interesting. And I think it gives an important perspective. And I think, you know, it's a truism that history is written by the victors. And obviously the, like, British colonial invasion and genocide was won by the British. But I think we can and should make an effort to find the stories from other voices that have been erased and listen to them. And we always try to do that on the show, but this is a very, like, literal instance of that, of listening to a story. So, this is Warren Foster.
When Captain Cook, James Cook, sailed up the coast there, we watched him. And when our old people seen him, they were wondering, what is that? Minjardin. Look there. What's that? Because we didn't see something so big and white swimming on water. And the only big thing we see swimming on the water is birds, budgeons. And he was shaped sort of like Gurungaba, the pelican. So our old people thought that he might have been one of them big budgeons coming back from dreamtime. Because when we talk about dream time, we talk about this one time. And when we do ceremonies, we go back into that one time.
It's a really gorgeous piece. And as you say, I think very important to engage with and try to understand the voices of those people who have been kind of silenced and marginalized by the colonial version of this story. But I think there's also an interesting discussion about the different ways that history is recorded. And one of the things that I saw in response to this story coming out was a horrible tweet from Mark Latham, who I hate to bring up because he's a racist dirtbag and nothing that he says is important. But he is kind of a good right-wing weather vane.
Yeah, definitely.
So his response to this was basically like, oh, we're just supposed to believe this story that was handed down through word of mouth through generations. It's not written down like hard facts like we have, which is like, there's so many problems with that. Firstly, the idea that written accounts can't change
totally,
like, from generation to generation is obviously extremely wrong. Also, a number of the, like, cultural and religious stories that he relies on started off as oral histories, including Bible stories.
Totally,
But
also, like, we didn't play this whole story there, but there's not really anything in it that could be wrong, you know? Like, there's not... It's a myth, if you want to think of it like that. But, the story is like, oh, yeah, we saw the boat, we were worried about it, we thought they might be greedy and try and steal our shit, and then they did, and then they disrespected our, like, mother mountain. It's like, what
points of fact absolute reflex
can you respond to there? Like,
well, that's it. Well, no, it's this automatic reflex from people like him and Andrew Bolton, who just have this, like, visceral reaction to anything that is even vaguely critical of Australia's colonial legacy as being, like, personally insulting them and their history. And it's like, it's just, dude, like, just fucking relax. Like, you need to learn how to allow a little bit of criticism of the things that you believe into your worldview, or you know, just going to be stuck being a flatulent fuckwit for the rest of your life. Which,
I mean, that's been their game plan so far, so I guess
it's worked out for them all right. Yeah. Why would they change it up now? But look, not to bring the conversation down, I guess, with mentioning those assholes, but I think it's really nice to acknowledge those different forms of storytelling and recording history, and interpreting it as well. You know, as you say, it's not a literal recount of what happened, but it's an interpretation of it, and it's a way to kind of make sense of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting from that perspective as well. So yeah, definitely check that out. So for mains this week, we thought we would just have kind of a loose chat as opposed to like going in depth on a particular news story or whatever. We'd have just a little bit of a conversation about something it was sparked by a comment thread in the Ozpol Shitposting Facebook group. Now, I think that it started on the post of someone who is a landlord.
Yeah.
And they were posting something negative about the QEIV.
REIQ, the Real Estate Institute of REIQ. Queensland. Yeah, so this thread was by a landlord who was saying, look, I'm a landlord, but these guys are being fucking dickheads. And it was specifically about like corona-related evictions and so on. I can't remember exactly what was in the REIQ statement that was objectionable, but it was just like basic landlord shit of like, don't let tenants not pay rent and that sort of thing. Mm. A bunch of people hopped on and were like, lol, you're a landlord. That's bad.
You
shouldn't be a landlord. I don't think anyone actually threatened him with a guillotine in that
particular
thread.
Guillotine memes,
okay,
yeah.
Sure. And look, this was one thread in the middle of a much wider conversation about landlordism and about landlords and renters and coronavirus world specifically. But then a bunch of people were like, look, this guy seems quite nice. It seems like his landlording is not super exploitative. He's doing it at below market rate for someone. He only owns two properties and blah, 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 blah. Like, this is the kind of landlord that we should be being like, yes, good landlord, thank you. This is a model that we should hold up for other people. And I was kind of saying, I was not in that group. I was leading the polite but firm
rebuttal.
And my view is basically like, sure, maybe he's renting at below market rate, but that still means that the person who's renting from him is paying off his mortgage for him. And like, it's still a parasitic relationship. And maybe, yes, if all landlords were like him, there wouldn't be such an issue, but I don't think that means that we need to like necessarily praise him or whatever. And anyway, so I'm getting a little bit deep into it. We didn't want to talk about that thread in endless detail because it was a while ago and it kind of wrapped up nicely. And I don't mean to call out that person who was very responsive and had an interesting conversation with me about it and so on. But we do want to talk about the sort of tension between individual and systematic or systemic responsibility and impacts. And landlords is an interesting one that comes up a lot in the discourse. But there are a bunch of other situations where personal and systematic responsibility are somewhat confusing and people argue for one or the other or whatever. So, yeah, that's what we wanted to chat about for the next minute.
Because the conference, like, I'm not sure that I totally agree with your characterization of what people were saying in that thread in support of the landlord. I feel like, it was more along the lines of, from what I saw, it was more along the lines of, like, we don't need to alienate this guy and tell him that everything that he says is worthless because he's a landlord therefore is like a class traitor and an enemy of Marxists and everywhere.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, there was some conversation about the complicating factors of landlordism in Australia, about the way that it has been so pushed so hard by governments over the past few decades to kind of represent a really safe investment and to be this aspirational
like
thing that everybody
Australian
should.
Identity with a quarter acre block and yeah.
Exactly. And the fact that, yeah, a lot of landlords aren't these kinds of don't have huge portfolios, but would look something more like your mum or dad.
Yeah.
Who, as in the case of this guy who had originally posted, was like, yeah, I had a house which I inherited from my parents and then I moved, and I got another place closer to my job. And so I rented out the old place to like pay for the new one kind of thing, which is like all very, it just very logical and and make sense when you're there. And like, I know people who own property as well and who is like still in my life.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, there was some conversation, I guess, about the reality of it, and as opposed to, say, this kind of ideological image of what a landlord is and what they represent. But so the conversation turned more to the lines that you're talking about, Noon, this sort of conversation about systemic versus individual responsibility. And so people were kind of arguing that because, like, that being a landlord is encouraged and enabled by the system that we exist in, it's not totally fair to put all of the responsibility for that on the people who end up in that position. And, you know, obviously it's nuanced, and it's not everybody who's a landlord is just like, oops, like, I own two properties and I rent one out. There's a lot of, like, extremely
cruel and wealthy and exploited people horrible. Doing it on purpose and so on. Yeah, yeah.
And those are the screen caps that get shared around in groups, like Ozpol shitposting people who have infiltrated landlord groups. And there are so many landlords who are absolutely despicable and who say things like, I would rather have my house be empty than let someone live in it for free. Or, you know, asking for ways that they can illegally kick out their tenants and stuff.
Yeah.
So it does absolutely breed, I think, as an economic relationship, disdain for tenants in landlords, 100%.
There's this line that I use a lot that is from Marx somewhere, that he says, someone is a capitalist to the extent that they act as capital personified. And I think that's really useful because it does help remind us that, like, yeah, landlords are real people and they have families and they're not normally trying to, like, actively hurt people except when they're being a landlord. And this is kind of what my fundamental point was on that thread, is that, like, when you're doing landlord shit, that's inherently exploitative. And there's no way to be a landlord that isn't like that. Now, the next, like, I guess maybe we could debate about that, but I feel like the real interesting question is, how much of that can you do and not be held extremely responsible for the systemic situation of landlords? Like, can you have five properties and be a cool landlord? Or, like, I don't know. Yeah. I think that's the tension that I'm interested in looking at.
It is, yeah. And I think it relates to a host of other social and economic issues that that I'm very interested in. So, I mean, I thought that you at one point made the comparison to vegetarians.
Yeah.
in the thread, which I thought was an interesting one, which obviously personally affects me because, yes, how can you tell when you're in a room with a vegan? Well, they'll let you know. And hello, yes, I am one. But I guess my attitude towards people eating animal products has undergone a few, I don't know, iterations, I guess, over the course of my time, like, learning about and becoming invested in animal rights. And you just have to basically draw a bit of a line between somebody's behaviors that pertain to a system that they've been indoctrinated into, as opposed to making value judgments about them as a person. And this is kind of what the conversation about the landlords came down to, is that you were basically saying, I think that being a landlord and doing landlord shit is inherently bad, and whether or not the person is nice or good doesn't come into it. But I think that kind of cuts both ways, in the sense that, like, well, you know, you are basically making that argument for it doesn't matter whether or not he's nice. But I guess you could also make the same argument to say, well, being a landlord doesn't make him inherently good or bad. And that's kind of where the correlation with the attitude towards meat eating came in for me, because you very quickly realize that if you're going around telling everybody that they're a bad person for eating animals, you're not going to convince anyone, you're not going to make any friends. And there are, like, large chunks of, like, the militant animal rights community who are totally alienated from every other element of the social justice community because of the taking this extremely hardline stance, for example. But I personally don't think that it makes someone a bad person if they eat meat. Because it's partially because it's basically an untenable position to hold socially. But also because ultimately what you eat is something that is almost to the level of like religion or your general ideological framework and the way you understand the world. Like, it's something that's instilled in you from an extremely young age. If you grow up in a household and you are fed meat and it's normalized, then it becomes a very complicated question to pass a value judgment on somebody who eats meat. I'm not sure it's in, and it's not exactly a one-to-one comparison with landlordism for a number of reasons, but
I think one big one being that you can like eat a meat meal and then not or whatever. Whereas when you're a landlord, you can't just like have a house sometimes and then not. It's like a lifestyle choice or whatever. You know, it you're committed to it in some way.
Yeah, I guess I see what you mean. If you sort of view it as a lifestyle and not as like a job, which it's obviously not. But I think a lot of the people who participate in it view it as kind of a source of income, and probably you would get some pushback along the lines of, well, are workers who are in the fossil fuel industry also not worthy of our solidarity, for example? That's a very, you know, I'm definitely not trying to make that argument.
But I do see the connection there. Yeah, and fossil fuels is another really interesting one, and there's a lot of sort of discourse about the personal versus the systemic with fossil fuels, and you know, from everything from how, like, is owning or driving a car a problem? Like, should we be mad at people for owning and driving cars? And it seems like, basically, as with vegetarianism, like, you can't really be like that.
Or you can.
But then you're a giant fucking idiot. Or, like, asshole that no one likes.
And then you have to call your friends who you've upset by telling them that driving a car makes them a bad person because you need to move house and you have some big furniture. And I'm not going to name names, but I think most of us have known someone like that at some point. When you're young, you know, you say these kind of hardline things and then you realize that life bumps up against those positions in some ways.
So what you're saying is that as I get older, I'll start to love capitalism? Is that what you're telling me, Zach? That's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been waiting for that to kick in for a while, but it's good to know it's on the way.
When I say young, I mean literally like 18, living in a share house.
Silly.
So was I to a certain extent.
We know that the petrol companies have spent huge amounts of money on preventing renewable cars from being developed and from like making sure that everyone uses cars all the time for everything. Yeah, I think we can't really get mad at people for driving cars because you kind of need to operate in society. I don't drive, and it's a huge fucking nuisance. And
things are just set up that way.
Yeah, exactly.
And we need to agitate for the fundamental changing of the way that our society is physically set up in order to need cars less. Like, that's an important piece
of
activism.
I think we've kind of got the wrong side of these comparisons, right? Like, eating animals and driving a car are pretty similar, but I think being a landlord is a bit more like being a butcher or like being a
petrol station owner.
Yeah, that, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
All right, go on.
I haven't like fully fleshed out this idea. I'm having it as we talk, but like, I think the analogy would be to say, hey, renters, you shouldn't be renting because you're supporting this unethical industry, right? Which is obviously not a feasible option. Whereas it is feasible to be like, hey, maybe this retailer or this wholesaler or this production facility shouldn't be operating. But again, I mean, like, there's a difference between some person working in an abattoir and the person who owns the abattoir. Like, I still think there's nuances within this, but like,
yeah, well, I mean, that, like, I guess we're talking about very different class dynamics for one thing. When you're talking about people who work in slaughterhouses, like, those are almost exclusively
very poor
people on working visas.
Yeah.
Yeah. often immigrant workers. And it's just absolutely horrible, soul-deadening work. Versus being a landlord, which is a very comfortable way of making money where you
have right. And this is what I'm saying. Is the landlord is more like the owner of the shop or whatever. But like,
totally, yes. Yeah. Totally agree with you there. I think the kind of main argument that was being had was more around, is it politically expedient for the left to automatically demonize and exclude landlords from any kind of discussion about this? So in this case, we were dealing with a person who came to the table with a bit of a leftist perspective and was complaining about the, more mainstream and corporate form of landlordism and trying to make a distinction between that and himself. And you were saying that that's maybe a spurious distinction to make. And other people were saying, should we be posting guillotine memes to this guy? Because how do we hope to reach anybody and change the system if everybody who participates in it is automatically excluded from the discussion? Which I think is a really valid point, but also really, really difficult to navigate. Because at the end of the day, we need to make it absolutely clear that landlordism is fucking unacceptable and that it is a system that is inherently exploitative and must be abolished, and participating in it is immoral. But at the same time, threading the needle, it's immoral to be actively participating in this, but also that doesn't make you a bad person. And also it doesn't mean that we don't want to talk to you about it. And it doesn't mean that you have to change your life overnight in order to become, to be seen as acceptable.
As I said, I think that the person who was who started that thread and who I was mostly responding to was engaging in completely good faith and was really listened to what I said and asked for more info and gave their thoughts. And I really enjoyed that conversation, and I didn't we don't have a no landlords policy in the group or whatever. So there was another fucking shit show of a shit post this morning that I don't want to go into, but I feel like people often think I'm making a much stronger point than I am when I think there's a small or medium sized point there. But I don't recall saying that guy should shut up or not be included in any conversation or whatever. I was having a conversation with him.
Was doing that. It was, but the initial responses to the post were why do you think you should be allowed to participate in this discussion this distinction between yourself and bad landlords because you were part of the same system? And I don't totally disagree with the ideology behind that statement, but I guess the question comes down to a little bit of trying to find these nuances of how to communicate with those people. But also, look, I want to put a bit of a disclaimer here and say that it's very common that these discussions revolve around how to make these conversations more comfortable for the people who are in these positions of power or who are exploiting others.
Totally.
And I don't want to, I don't want to place importance on that above, say, people having access to shelter when they need it. We are the abolition of landlords. We want to make that clear. But there's, I guess there's interesting nuances in sort of how to get there. And in general, I'm not a guillotine memes kind of person.
No. There's a bit of that in the group, but it's not my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, and, I don't... It's not a value judgment about people who choose to kind of meme that way, but, I guess I've sort of gone off, those edgier kinds of memes in general. Go on.
I was going to say, maybe sometimes political violence might be necessary or the best option or whatever, but even if that is the case in certain situations, we shouldn't be excited or happy or looking forward to or glorifying that or laughing about it. It's not a funny thing if it has to happen. It's it's a horrible duty or something,
And that's why I felt kind of uncomfortable about the Boogaloo memes that were being posted. For anyone who doesn't know, Boogaloo is... it started as a term specifically to describe a second civil war, a race war in the United States, as in Civil War II, Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah.
And has since I have learned through the shitposting group has kind of been adopted by, I think it's maybe it's not fair to call them tanky groups, but like militant leftist meme pages, for example, which are, kind of like making jokes about political violence.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't love that stuff. I don't have, you know, I'm not going to tell people that they can't communicate that way because it's definitely not my place. But it's not something that I'm particularly, particularly engaged with. But look, we've sort of gotten off the topic a little bit here. We were trying to talk about where that line between individual and systemic responsibility lies, and like how much responsibility does an individual have to resist, I guess, systemic oppression in their everyday actions. When, like, for someone like a landlord, they will probably be giving up a lot less by choosing a different source of income than somebody would be by, say, okay, I am not going to engage with any kind of product or service that it uses fossil fuels, for example. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a really interesting, maybe interesting is the wrong word, but that's a topic that comes up, I think, that I see coming up a lot, specifically like in relation to climate action, basically. And so
the whole 100 companies thing.
Exactly. So there are 50 companies who are responsible for 70% of the world's emissions,
which is something that
people love to a statistic that people love to throw around.
But does that mean that you can then drive your Humvee up and down just for fun for hours on end, or like?
Well, I honestly see people making the argument that like advocating for any kind of individual change on climate is playing into the hands of fossil fuel companies by making it an issue of personal and individual responsibility as opposed to systemic or corporate responsibility. And there's definitely truth to that. And we know that companies and corporations and governments have deliberately shifted the conversation to individual action because it means they don't have to do anything. It's a little bit of a tangent, but there's the story of the Keep America Beautiful campaign, which is a story that one of our activist friends named Lee loves to talk about, which is that campaign was created by manufacturers of like junk food in the United States. When along highways, basically as packaged food started to proliferate, so did rubbish. And instead of taking responsibility for that and producing, say, biodegradable packaging or funding cleanup efforts or installing public bins or anything like that, they started a public information campaign that it was about, it's your job to keep America beautiful. You, by the consumer, littering. The individual. Mm. Exactly. And so, and that's a great illustration of exactly how it benefits corporations to talk about individual action and responsibility. So that is a really important thing to acknowledge. But at the same time, I see people using that logic to shut down anybody who suggests making any kind of alteration to the way that you individually live your life, and criticizing and shitting on people who try to do that stuff, which I think is extremely unproductive. Because at the end of the day, like, sure, it's 50 companies who are responsible for 70% of those emissions, but what are they doing? Mm. What are they producing?
And like, where obviously, companies are made of people in some fundamental way.
Well, exactly. And like, you want them to what? Maintain the exact level of like economic production, but just switch to 100% renewable energy? Is that your plan? Because I don't think that's going to happen.
Mm. And actually, renewable energy generation is a great example of this. Of like, Australia has emitted vastly less pollution because of solar PV energy generation. But on the other hand, it shouldn't be the job of like my next door neighbors to fucking install solar panels when they don't have any control over the coal mines or whatever. Like, yes, so I think here we're kind of looking at positive action, which I think feels a bit different than negative action. So positive action of like, I'm going to get solar panels, I'm going to, you know, do something else positive to like improve the world in some way, versus negative of like avoiding or boycotting or that sort of thing. And I feel like from my point of view, encouraging people to make positive personal changes is much more sustainable than encouraging people to make negative personal changes, you know, of like, and in some ways that's just a like semantic thing or like a phrasing thing. But you were the one who told me actually about how language like meat free or no meat or vegetarian or whatever is less effective than being like a plant-based alternative or whatever. And I think that, yeah, I'm not sure how that applies to landlords though, of like being like, yeah, it's good when landlords reduce rent or something like that, that that's a positive thing that we should be encouraging people to do. But then should we not also be encouraging people to like reduce it to zero and abolish themselves as landlords or something? Like, I don't know. Yeah.
No, it becomes very complicated when you're trying to use these analogies. And in fact, I'm coming, like, basically the argument that I'm making here around climate action on an individual and systemic level is sort of the inverse position that I was taking before regarding landlords, in the sense that what I'm trying to say is it's both. In every situation, it's both. And yes, we need massive systemic change, and that has to come from forcing corporations to do the right thing. But that is going to come with individuals changing their behavior. That's necessarily, it's a necessary part of decarbonizing our economic and social systems, right? You can't expect reduced emissions across the like industrial sector without having to make some changes to your lifestyle. And that might mean driving less, for example, and it might mean, you know, using reusable like jars instead of buying stuff that's wrapped in plastic. And of course, advocating for just that stuff and saying it's your responsibility to stop climate change by using reusable packaging completely misses the point and does what, you know, we were discussing before, which is place the responsibility on individuals. But I think people use sometimes this idea of corporate or governmental responsibility for issues as a way to avoid having to personally change their own behavior or do anything about it.
So maybe we could say something like, it's okay to encourage landlords to stop being landlords on a personal level, so long as you also are working to dismantle landlordism as a cultural institution and cornerstone of the economy.
Yeah, and I think that's basically, you know, this, if you apply what I'm saying to landlords, it's that landlords do have a responsibility.
Yeah.
Like they have to actively participate in that dismantling if they're going to be and participate in those conversations. Otherwise they can't lean on the excuse of the system was set up like this and I'm just one lowly participant in it. I think you need to do both and engage with both. I don't know if that's a particularly coherent or useful point of view. And there's like heaps of stuff here that we're kind of glossing over and not getting into. And yeah, I definitely don't want to sound like I'm coming down on the side of like people who want to ban straws, for example. Like that's a particularly egregious example of the shifting of the blame to the individual, and also something that massively
harms people who need straws. Yeah,
exactly. So there's obviously good and bad versions of doing both of like taking either approach. And I think that we need balance in that respect. And that wasn't really something that I saw being expressed in that comment thread that I kind of wanted to unpack a little bit. So I don't know. Cool. I mean, that was a pretty messy conversation, but you know,
hopefully you got something out of it. And yeah, if you have any thoughts about what we said or if we missed things, which we 100% did, but like, yeah, let us know what you reckon about it. Because
I reckon people are going to have thoughts.
Yeah,
come and share your thoughts.
Send us a potluck. Maybe you can email it to us at ozpolsnackpod@gmail.com. Just record yourself talking on your phone for a minute. Let us know.
Please do. Otherwise, you can come and find us on the Ozpol Shitposting Facebook group.
We're also on Instagram.
That's right. And the other place where you can chat with us is on Discord.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think we maybe forgot to post a link to it on the last bonus episode. So we'll post a link with this one. We've opened up. It's usually for patrons only, but we've opened up a free channel for everybody when the lockdown started. So that's the other place where you can get at us and tell us that we're wrong about everything that we discussed and all of the examples that we missed and how we're trots. Cool. Well, that probably just about does us for this week. Thank you, Noon, as always, for sharing this time with me. It's always a pleasure to see your face. Absolutely. And hear your thoughts. I hope everybody else has enjoyed Noon's thoughts as much as I have. And I also hope that they keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.